This is a Building Bridges Women's History Month special. I'm Amy Rosenberg. Women's History Month is about the complexity, the scope, and the depth of women's thoughts, accomplishments, and influence in the family, in society, in the world, and forces us inward to consider ourselves, and also pushes us outward to evaluate and appreciate our ongoing struggle for equality. A legend, Ruby Dee, creator, humanist, activist, brings to life the writings of John Oliver Killens from his landmark novel of social protest that chronicles the lives of the Youngblood family in Crossroads, Georgia, and Laurie Lee. Ruby Dee exquisitely renders Laurie Lee, ordinary, extraordinary woman who must define her own sense of dignity in the face of petty, mean-spirited, wanton discrimination. And Ruby conjures up the ordinary, extraordinary sojourner truth and reminds us of the 400 years in America of female disenfranchisement. And oh yes, that the women rise.
One day I received an invitation in the mail that inspired these thoughts that I put together and called Calling All Women. Calling all sisters, calling all righteous sisters, calling all women, calling all righteous women to steal away to our secret place and have a meeting face to face, look at the facts and determine our pace. Calling all women who want to reach first and second and third world women. Come together, women in and outside the power structure, working women, welfare women, women who feel alienated and isolated, women who are all frustrated, who have given up women, women questioning women. Women unpolarized, unorganized, ostracized, tired of being and penalized. Come, help us start to bridge the gaps, racial, cultural, generation. We want action and veneration. These men, they just ain't doing it. They've had hundreds of years and they're about to ruin it. Kitchen, office, ex-prison women, singing, dancing, diapering women, old and young and middle-aged women, make this scene. Oh yes, and bring you lunch. Problems, common problems that we make and cause each other. Sister, daughter, old grandmother, female child, you can bring your little brother. Take the subway, grab a cab, ride a bike, or pick them up and lay them down. Democracy or socialism, here and now or futurism. We just can't afford a schism. We got to get together or die. Now is the time for evolution. Let's all search and find solutions for how we'll make the next revolution or die. Oh yes. And don't forget your lunch.
God Almighty, God above.
Sojourner Truth was born a slave in New York and freed in 1827 when the state liberated its slaves. She did domestic work and after a period of religious revivalism became an active abolitionist, exchanging her name Isabella for the name Sojourner Truth. She did valiant service in the anti-slavery and women's rights cause. When she died in November 1883, the New York Globe, a black weekly, declared, "Sojourner Truth stands preeminently as the only colored woman who gained a national reputation on the lecture platform in the days before the war." The speech you're about to hear was made at the Women's Rights Convention in Akron, Ohio in 1851. Some of the delegates to the convention urged that she not be allowed to speak, fearing that the abolitionists would harm their cause. But Frances Dana Gage, who was presiding, invited her to speak. Sojourner Truth directed her remarks against the previous speaker, a clergyman, who had ridiculed the weakness and helplessness of women, who should, he said, not be entrusted with the vote.
"Well, children, where there is so much racket, there must be something out of kilter. I think that twixt niggers of the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white man will be in a fix pretty soon. But what's all this here talking about? That man over there say that women needs to be helped into carriages and lifted over ditches, and to have the best place everywhere. Well, nobody ever helps me into carriages or over mud puddles or gives me any best place. And ain't I a woman? Now, look at my arm. I have plowed and planted and gathered unto barns, and no man could head me. And ain't I a woman? I could work as much and eat as much as any man and bear the lashes well. And ain't I a woman? Now, I have borne 13 children and seen most all of them sold off to slavery. And when I cried out with my mother's grief, none but Jesus heard me. And ain't I a woman? Then it talks about what this thing in the head, what's this they call it? Intellect, yeah, that's it, honey. What that got to do with women's rights or niggers' rights? If my cup won't hold but a pint and yon holds a quart, wouldn't you be mean not to let me have my little half measure full? Then that little man in black there, he say women can't have as much rights as men 'cause Christ want a woman. Well, where did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? From God and a woman. Man had nothing to do with him. If the first woman God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, these women together ought to be able to turn it back and get it right side up again. And now they is asking to do it. The men better let them."
"I want you to stand up tall and proud. I want you to speak up clear and loud. Brown baby, so lie away sleeping, lie away here in my arms, while your daddy and mommy protect you and keep you safe from harm. Oh, you brown baby, brown baby, as years go by, I want you to go with your head held high. I want you to live by."
I'd like to read to you something from Youngblood by John Oliver Killen.
"I want you to walk down the freedom road."
She turned those
narrow, slanting kind of eyes of hers, with the heavy-laden eyelids. And she looked at that old hand-me-down from the white folks' clock over the mantelpiece. Lord, Lord, the children would be coming through that door any minute now, and what would it be today? Yesterday, it was Robbie coming in with his big toe bleeding, and she wiped her face with a big white rag as she stood over the ironing board, pushing a hot flat iron. White folks' clothes. She hardly had time to do her own family's. Work, 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 night and day. It was hard, mighty hard. But she would stand over the white folks' clothes out in her backyard till her back broke. It meant a better life for her children. Feet pounding up the stairs. Mama, 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 mama. The front door swung open, and the skinny little girl ran into her mother's arms. Big brown eyes, wide and tear-swollen, tracks down the sides of her face, made by dust and tears and Georgia dirt. She tried desperately to talk, but sobs and tears strangled her and kept her from talking. What in Jesus' name, big sister? Where in the world you been? Big sister took a deep breath, her flat chest pumping as if each breath were her last breath.
They locked Robbie up.
What they? Who locked him up? Mama, still trying to remain calm, trying hard to keep cool.
You know, that old, long, tall policeman, Mama, you know, named Skinny McGuire. You know, Mama, he told me to come get you.
There now, tell me, honey, how come
that white boy and Mama wasn't doing nothing but walking by up Planter's Alley all by myself? But I fought him, Mama. It was just too many of them.
Where was Robbie? I mean, wasn't he with you? Why the devil didn't the girl tell the story right along without stopping?
No. See, my class let out early, so I started home all by myself. And then them white boys, about four of them, they double-teamed me, and they threw me on the ground. And I tried to bust one of them puckle peckers was wide open, but it was too many of them, Mama. Hands under my dress, yelling. They were yelling. They were yelling.
And big sister's nose sniffling, her words, her hands rubbing her great big eyes, her meager breast pumping in and out.
They were yelling, nigga pussy, nigga pussy.
And Laura bit her lips and her eyes, and she bit her, and her eyes remembered another time, another place, another alley. And a drunken man, remembering also Big Mama. Ah, Lord, honey, God damn it. White man make way with black woman, and black man bet not even now say a mumbling word. And looking down at Big Sister, she almost shouted, no, 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 God, Jesus, no. But she, the mother, had to control herself. She said, all right, Big Sister, all right. And Laurie bathed her trembling legs in privates and put iodine on the scratches. Now, baby doll, it's all right. It's all right, Big Sister. It's not so bad, baby. Honey, now, don't cry anymore. And she took off Jenny Lee's shoes and pulled the sheet up to her neck. You all right now, Big Sister? You all right? And she got ready to go downtown to the courthouse, moving quick-like, but without obvious excitement. And when she was ready, she went to the fireplace and took the irons off the charcoals and sat them on the hearth. And she took the ironing board down from its perch atop of two straight chairs and leaned it against the wall. She went to the bed, kissed Jenny Lee on her sweaty forehead. She said, all right, now, honey, I'm going to go down to the courthouse and get your brother. You just lie still and rest yourself. You feel better before we get back. You get yourself some dinner here. Robbie and me be back before a cat can wink his eye. And she got off the bus and walked through Jeff Davis Square and found herself in front of the courthouse and awed by its big size. And she met a policeman in the long marble corridor on the main floor, and he told her where to find Officer McGuire.
Thank you, sir. Room 12, room 12. Please, Lord, don't let him do it. Not to my Robbie. Lord, not to Robbie. breathing deeply now, trying to calm herself and quiet down a great fear that had built up inside of her. Because she couldn't go into the room looking like this. They mustn't suspect. So she wiped her face and took a deep breath and knocked on the door. "Howdy, Laurie." Skinny McGuire greeted her, friendly-like. "How are you, Mr. McGuire?" Another man in a gray suit, wearing a big fuzzy hat, sat at the other end of the room behind a desk, and he looked up as Laurie entered, and Skinny McGuire picked something out of his nose and flicked it on the floor and looked at it for a moment, then flushed embarrassment, and he cleared his throat and spoke like he had memorized a speech. "Got your boy down here, Laurie, fighting white boys, little white boys coming home from school. Serious offense, Laurie. Don't be you and Joe's young'un. Wouldn't let him off so easy. Y'all some mighty good colored folks, and we don't want to see your boy get into no trouble. I'll go get him now."
"Oh, thank you, sir,"
Laurie said in a restrained overflow of gratitude. Lucky it had been Skinny McGuire that arrested her boy, instead of one of those hateful cops that like to lock Negroes up and beat them up too. The boy came back in the room with Skinny. He looked proud and rebellious, standing there just about caught up with Laurie in height, and gonna be tall and powerful like his daddy. He stood pigeon-toed, just like Joe Youngblood. And his eyes brightened, he widened and crinkled at the corners. Now that Mama was here, nothing really serious could happen to him. And Mama saw it in his eyes and the way he held his mouth and understood what it meant and felt good over it. "You know what to do," Laurie heard Skinny's voice saying vaguely, bringing her back to the reality of the courthouse office. And she turned and saw Skinny taking something resembling a buggy whip down from behind the door. Detachedly watched him handing it towards her. She didn't move, just stood there, overcome, like she was struck dumb and paralyzed. "You know what to do," he prompted. "He's getting off light at that. Most colored boys would have got some time. There ain't no lie. Reformatory full of them." And she knew what to do, all right. Now it was clear to her what they expected and the alternative. The reformatory. God, Jesus, have mercy. She saw Robbie's face as Skinny handed the whip to her. There wasn't the slightest doubt in his mind that his mother would refuse to take it. His eyes narrowed arrogantly, mouth set in a kind of curved upward pout, shoulders back, legs apart, feet toed in. Nothing could touch him. The man under the fuzzy hat coughs and cleared his throat. Another look at Robbie, and she swallowed and pressed her lips together and made up her mind not to lash her son in front of these white men, no matter what. It was an ugly, murderous looking whip. An oversized razor strop sliced into three pieces. A shiver passed through her body, her legs trembled, and shame and pride gone now before these white men, replaced in her eyes by a terrible, humiliating fear. She turned to Officer McGuire, handing the whip back to him. She said, "Oh, can I take him home and whip him, please, sir, Mr. McGuire?" Skinny wouldn't confront the desperation in the woman's face. He looked down at his big feet and over at his desk. "You know that ain't the way it's done, Laura. You know better than that." And she wished the boy were temporarily deaf.
Didn't want them to hear her pleading to white folks like this, like getting on her knees, like stripping buck naked in Jeff Davis Square. Please, sir, Miss Delgrave, I'll give him a whipping. He'll never forget the longest day he lives. I'll skin him alive. The man at the desk did some long and drawn out throat clearing, muttered something to himself. Skinny flushed red in the face, his keen voice hardened.
Listen, woman, don't be for me. You be here begging me not to send him to the reformatory. After all, he was fighting white boys, goddammit. God darn it.
She wiped her face with her arm, and she turned toward her boy, who was looking a hole in the cement floor, and a feeling of complete lifelessness and had seized her entire body. And Skinny's voice was apologetic. Make him put off his coat. Make him put off his jacket. Pull off your jacket, Robbie, she said, avoiding his bewildered, unbelieving eyes. And the boy looked up into his mother's harassed face, his eyes asking questions. He didn't know his mother acting this way. Laurie was a different person, a total stranger who wore mama's face. Don't be a bully, she always said. Don't pick a fight, but don't be a coward either. You can't run away from life, she always said. Don't pick a fight, but you're as good as any white person alive and much better than a whole heap of them. But this was his mother, the person he trusted above everybody, loved 1,000 times more than anything or anybody in the world. And without another word, his tongue slipped over his lip. And he swallowed hard as he began to unbutton his jacket. His lips working noiselessly, hands trembling slightly, and a quivering hardness in his stomach, and a nervous fear he didn't want these people to know about. Her face was a total blank as she raised the whip above her head. The first blow made a 3-lane welt across his back, but it only winced, didn't utter a sound. She raised her arm again, and she felt like taking the whip and lashing these white men until every bit of breath left their bodies. And she wished that every white person in the world here at this very moment under her power. She would lash the life out of them one by one with a smile on her face. Whack! Another red trail across her boy's back. And he didn't cry. He just winced and moved his short body sideways. Whack! Whack! And after a while, it seemed that she was out of her own body, standing there watching another woman who looked like her, her eyes following each flight of the whip, up, up and down, up and down, her own son receiving each murderous lick, and she, powerless to stop this crazy beast of a woman, paralyzed from head to foot. She vaguely heard the plainclothesman in the corner say, "Damn, tough little nigger buck, tough as whip leather, if he'd only cry out, show some sort of pain instead of that look on his face of grown folks' sassiness." Whack! The whip bit into his flesh like an angry rattlesnake, cutting the welts open. Blood seeped out and spread over his back. A tremble started in Laurie's legs and ran upwards all over her body. Her eyes were wide now, pleading that the boy's eyes opened, pleading for her to stop. And the sweat had dripped into her own eyes and mixed with tears forming there and almost blinded her. And she turned towards the crackers with her arm at her side, and her eyes begged them to let her stop whipping him. Her angry lips quivered. "No more, no more. Please, no more, no more." And one of them said, she wasn't sure which, wasn't sure of anything by now, "You ain't hurt that boy yet. He ain't even cried. Reformatory full of boys like him. You better give that sassy buck a good whooping. You don't want him in the reformatory." Now her arm was a mold of cement as she saw the blood flow freely now. Nasty and spattering. Some of it on her dress. Her own blood from her own flesh, and she was drawing it. Everything was blurred and white for her now. The room with its white walls seemed to be closing in on her. Skinny and the other white man blended into the white mass of the office, the desk, the floor, the hat rack, everything the color of cotton blossoms now and closing in. And cigar smoke, white, choking cloud. And for a moment, even the boy before her was white and the blood on his back. And Robert began to whimper like a puppy, suffering slow and deliberate torture. She said she was somewhere far away as she heard him beaten to the floor and kicking like a dying animal. He said, "No, we'll be no more, Mama. Not do anything you say. Please, please, Mama, don't whip me no more. Oh, Lordy, Mama. It hurts so bad. Don't kill me. Mama, Mama, Mama." She tried to raise her arm, but the strength and the will had deserted her. She turned towards Skinny. "That's enough, Laurie. He done learned his lesson, I reckon." And Laurie gave the blood-dripping whip to Sonny and reached for Robbie's jacket. The other white man's voice cut the air like a buggy whip. "Make him say he ain't gonna fight white boys no more." His big mouth was smiling, a flash of gold teeth upper center. And Laura slipped the left sleeve of the jacket carefully over Robbie's arm and started towards the door, but tarrying a second to button up his jacket. The voice rose to a higher pitch. "Tell him, make him say he ain't gonna fight white boys, I said." The smile on his big mouth widened as he lit another cigar. Laurie kept walking with Robbie towards the door. It seemed a million miles away. "Skinny, tell him, make him say he ain't gonna fight white boys no more, God damn it!" Skinny called out to Laurie, his thin face drawn thinner and red as a beet. "Don't go yet, Laurie." And Laurie turned, and she and Robbie standing in the open door. She could feel her boy's whole body trembling. Her mouth tasted like the bile from a chicken. Skinny said, "Tell him he ain't gonna fight tell him say he ain't gonna fight white boys no more." Her eyelids heavier than ever, the narrow eyes empty now. "You tell him," she said. "I've done all I'm gonna do." And the man with the broad golden smile and eyes like steel balls adjusted his fuzzy hat. And he got up from the desk and walked around and rested his big bottom on the edge of it. And, "What the hell's wrong with you, Skinny? You let a nigger woman talk to you like that?" And his big hand rubbed himself nervously between his legs like a little boy playing with himself. And Skinny's long face turned various shades of red and popped out all over with sweat. Woman, you don't want no more trouble. Tell the boy what I say. Tell the boy what I say, God darn it. You want him to go to the reformatory?" She turned to Robbie. Her voice sounded like somebody else's voice. "Say it, Robbie." The boy didn't open his mouth. He kept looking at the floor. "For Jesus' sake, say it, son. Say it." He didn't look up. He barely heard himself mumble. The mother, Laurie, barely heard him mumble, "Not gonna fight white boy anymore." They walked down the steps of the courthouse, empty-eyed, heads swinging beneath their slouching shoulders, and Laurie looked sideways at Robbie and put a hand on his curly head, and he pulled away from her. "Robbie," I had to do it, son. Couldn't help myself at all. They'd have put you in that reformatory like they did your uncle, like you did your Uncle Tim. And God in heaven knows I just couldn't stand it. Understand me, Robbie's son. God in heaven knows that reformatory is the worst place in the whole wide world. Her swollen eyes begged him. Robbie didn't say anything to Laura Lee, didn't even look in her direction. He just pushed his hands deeper in his pockets and stared great big holes in the paved sidewalk. At home, Laurie finished doctoring the boy's back and gave him another shirt, and he stood before her, head down, already beyond her shoulders in height, feet toed inward, hate burning fiercely in his narrow eyes, and she was angry with him for not understanding her, for not understanding. Yet somehow she wanted to take him in her arms and with her overpowering love blot out everything that had happened that day. And she looked him up and down and she made herself smile as she remembered the other day when she and Robbie had been going down Apple Street together, and Joe Jessup, the barber, had asked him how old he was. And when Robbie had said 11, Joe had stood away from him and said, measuring Robbie's size with his eyes, and said, "Woo-wee!" Joe exclaimed. He said, "Boy, you never see 11 no more till you get 111. A feeling of anger rising again inside of her towards him and Jenny Lee, as his sister, as he stood there with his head down, accusing her, his mother, as if she hadn't sacrificed for him, both of them, every single hour since they came into the world, and always praying that God willing they should have a better life than she had. But now she stood there almost hating him, wanting somehow to beat him into understanding. God Almighty, damn the white folks. They're not satisfied with treating you like it's still slavery time. They turn your own children against you. You're not eating anything, son. I'm not hungry. And Laurie was aware of Big Sister seated at the other end of the kitchen on the side of her bed, and her eyes upon the book in her lap, but her ears and her mind taking everything in. "But you must be hungry, honey. You haven't eaten a thing hardly. And I fixed it specially for you." "Now this part is not burnt, darling. And that's just your favorite. Don't feel like eating nothing," he muttered as he left the table and ran into the other room. She walked to the door. He was lying on her bed, his face buried in the spread, crying for the fear and insecurity and confusion that suddenly seized him, weeping for the love and respect and devotion that she had beaten out of him, because he felt lonely and mad and betrayed and forsaken and loveless like a motherless child. And she understood it. In his own house, he could cry and cry and cry some more, and he didn't have to spare Mama, because there was nothing between him and her anymore. And she walked over to the bed and rubbed his head gently, and he shook his head and squirmed away from her as if her hand were a red hot poker. And then she sat in the rocker near the fireplace. The rain beat an off-time rhythm on the window and on the roof. And sleeping weather. Rain all night. Rain. Maybe I'll be able to get me some sleep. She rocked back and forth with a nervous motion. "Robbie, come over here. But you two come in here, big sister. I want to talk to you, both of you." The boy came, taking his good time, and they sat on the floor in front of her. And she didn't know how to begin. It was like groping around in a strange, dark house, clumsy, stumbling, uncertain, even afraid. "Robbie, both of you, I mean, you don't understand. about what happened in that courthouse today. You, how come you to do it, Mama? The boy asked. Nervously, she rocked back and forth, and then, well, it's not so easy to explain. You see, I mean, the white folks in this town and all over the country, I reckon, especially down south here, they think that they're better than all the colored people. And you all know that, both of you. They got the whole world in their hip pockets, and they aim to keep it that way. And they gonna keep the colored man under their feet as long as he let them. And they aren't gonna stand for us fighting back and fair and square. Nothing in the children's faces moved. Not a lip nor an eyelash. Did I do wrong, Mama? Sitting there, both of them, as if they were the white prosecutors and she the black prisoner. It isn't a matter of right or wrong. It's just that, but did I do wrong? His young face was pulled hard and tight, uncompromising. In the eyes of the white folks, yes. And that's why you beat me. She answered in a weary tone that said, this is all I'm gonna say about it. This is all. So clean out your ears and get it straight. If I hadn't done it, they'd have put you in the reformatory. Now you'll get all the whipping, but if they put you in that reformatory, you'd never get over it. Now I told you that already, Robbie. And she shivered like she was having a chill. And he made sure she had finished talking this time. And then he said, I don't like white people. I hate every one of them. See every last one of them in hell or on the chain gang. Without looking at her again, he walked quickly into the kitchen. She started to tell him to come back. To say to him, she shouldn't hate all white people, that all white people wasn't like that. Give him some kind of hope. Tell him hate was a mean thing. And tell her all the other things her Christian upbringing had always taught her. But she didn't say anything because at that moment, she herself hated the whole human race. Maybe God Almighty himself. From John Oliver Kearns.
A poem by Langston Hughes describes a mother's advice to her son, and if you listen, you can hear the working woman.
Well, son, I'll take it. Life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had tacks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor, bare. But all the time, I's been a-climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners, and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So boy, don't you turn back. Don't you sit down on the steps because you finds it kind of hard. Don't you fall now. For I still going, honey. I still climbing. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair.
How long, Lord?
Oh, how long, Lord?
How long? Mm.
Although she was already over 80 years of age, the great black fighter for human freedom, Sojourner Truth, was still engaged in the cause. A pioneer in the struggle for women's rights as well as for the freedom of her people from slavery, Sojourner Truth made the rights of women a special feature for all her talks in the years following emancipation. She spoke twice at the first annual meeting of the American Equal Rights Association held in New York City on May 9th and 10th, 1867. She closed her first speech by singing, "We Are Going Home," and that evening again addressed the delegates of women engaged in the battle for equality with men and a few progressive men who also attended the session. Here is the major part of Sojourner Truth: "When women gets her rights, man will be right."
My friends, I am rejoiced that you are glad, but I don't know how you'll feel when I get through. I come from another field, the country of the slave. They have got their rights. So much good luck. Now, what is to be done about it? I feel that I have as much responsibility as anybody else. I have as good rights as anybody. There is a great stir about colored men getting their rights, but not a word about the colored women. And if colored men get their rights and not colored women get theirs, there will be a bad time about it. So I am for keeping the thing going while things are still stirring, because if we wait till it is still, it will take a great while to get it going again. White women are a great deal smarter and know more than colored women. While colored women do not know scarcely anything, they go out washing, which is about as high as a colored woman gets. And their men go about idle, strutting up and down. And when the women come home, they ask for their money and take it all and then scold because there's no food. I want you to consider on that, children. I want women to have their rights. In the courts, women have no right, no voice. Nobody speaks for them. I wish women to have her voice there among the pettifoggers. If it is not a fit place for women, it is unfit for men to be there. I am above 80 years old. It's about time for me to be going, but I suppose I am kept here because something remains for me to do. I suppose I am yet to help break the chain. I have done a great deal of work, as much as any man, but did not get so much pay. I used to work in the field and buying grain, keeping up with the cradler. But men never doing no more got twice as much pay. So with the German women. They work in the field and do as much work, but do not get the pay. We do as much, we eat as much, we want as much. I suppose I am about the only colored woman that goes about to speak for the rights of the colored woman. I want to keep the thing stirring now that the ice is broken. What we want is a little money. You men know that you get as much again as women when you write or for what you do. When we get our rights, we shall not have to come to you for money, for then we shall have money enough for our own. It is a good consolation to know that when we have got this, we shall not be coming to you anymore. You have been having our rights so long that you think, like a slaveholder, that you own us. I know that it is hard for one who's held the reins for so long to give up. It cuts like a knife. It will feel all better when it closes up again. I have been in Washington about 3 years seeing about those colored people. Now, colored men have a right to vote, and what I want is to have colored women have the right to vote. There ought to be equal rights more than ever since colored people have got their freedom. I know that it is hard for men to give up entirely. They must run in the old track. I was mused how men speak up for one another. They cannot bear that a woman should say anything about the man. But they will stand here and take up the time in man's cause. Now, some men are trying to help us. I know that. But they cannot help us as much until some of the spirit is taken out of them that belongs among the women. Men have got their rights, and women has not got their rights. That is the trouble. When woman gets her rights, man will be right. How beautiful that will be. Then it will be peace on earth and goodwill to men, but it cannot be until it be right. It will come. Yes, it will come quickly. It must come. And now when the waters is troubled, and now is the time to step into the pool. There is a great deal now with the minds, and now is the time to start forth. The great fight was to keep the rights of the poor colored people. That made a great battle. And now I hope that this will be the last battle that will be in the world. Let us finish up here so that there will be no more fighting. I have faith in God, and there is truth in humanity. Be strong, women. Blush not, tremble not. I want you to keep a good faith and good courage. And I'm going round after I get my business settled and get more equality. People in the North, I am going round to lecture on human rights. I will shake every place I go to.
As we go marching, marching in the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand millions gray, are touched with all the radiance that a sudden sun discloses. For the people hear us singing, bread and roses, bread and roses.
In Ruby Dee's Calling All Women, her readings from Langston Hughes, John Oliver Killens, or the words of Sojourner Truth, she presents us with an antidote. Women, while often on the lowest rung of the socioeconomic scale, refused shabby treatment and asserted themselves, sometimes in the one area they could give or not give their affection. We celebrate that and place that in bold relief. It is an enduring legacy we all must proudly claim. Ruby Dee is multidimensional. She doesn't hide from reality and confronts the facts of life with candor. She is warm, generous, but she also makes demands. And Ruby rises to tell the truth and expect the same in return. She clarifies chaos, knows what she wants, and spells it out.
Ruby Dee, do you think that trade unions have the same significance today? Are they doing enough around the social conditions?
Well, I think trade unionism is struggling to stay alive in the consciousness of working people. I don't think most working people understand the contribution of union to labor and the improvement of the working conditions in terms of money and so many instances, the labor unions have made the difference. And we forget, you know, we forget that people struggle to get an 8-hour day and a minimum wage. And, you know, these were a class of people whose whole lives were dedicated to the eradication of child labor and decent physical conditions surrounding in the workplace, and so many things that the labor union is responsible for that people forget had to be struggled and fought for. I mean, the very fact of an 8-hour day, for example. And so we tend to take these things for granted, and we forget about the part that organized people who organized and got together and brought about improvements for workers. But I think that somehow we have to stay reminded. And those in power tend to want to make working people forget, tend to make us pit workers against each other worldwide, you know, so we no longer have, industries have moved out of the country altogether. These things can flourish better where you can pay workers at a much lower rate than you can pay workers in this country. Thank God that some of the unions are still strong. and we'll teach others, you know, the value of the union. Looking at labor as a necessary backbone of a civilization. If you don't have a healthy working class, you won't have a healthy nation very long. We need to pay attention. We need to study the history of the union. The unions, we need to fight and insist on the rights of workers and look at the history of labor. And it's, you know, and there's no doubt in my mind that's part of the price of freedom is vigilance, eternal vigilance. And labor, and the rights of labor, is such an enormous part of that freedom. I think the risks are greater because greed is in the saddle and consumerism is in the saddle. There are those who would undo the Constitution. Those people are in the saddle. The rights of the ordinary human being are at stake. So, and therefore those who recognize these things have to cry louder and longer, and there's so much pressure against them to survive. Because believe me, those who would destroy the labor movement would destroy the country in a sense, but don't care about the country. Because you cannot love freedom, you cannot love America and denigrate the labor movement and not understand and seek its strength and its health. Because that's what is so marvelous about the country, the rights and the opportunities and the necessity for a healthy labor movement. I think it's going to be harder, because the thing that occurs to me is the demons are in the saddle. How can I describe it? There's this great disrespect for the worker has no protection. There's no, so you turn to the very, you turn to the destroyers looking for fairness and justice and help, and it doesn't make sense. You have to have an independent labor movement to make this country work. It has to be strong and respectful. You know? I don't know. I wish I were wiser and could come up with some really...
Are you cynical at this period? Are you optimistic? How do you sustain yourself, and how do you look at this period of history?
Well, despite corruption, despite the very fact that our president is in office under a cloud of dishonesty, greed is in the saddle. But despite all that, I can't despair. I think of this line from Lorraine Hansberry, who says, "How dare you despairing ones think that only you know the truth?" I think that the people who love, the lovers of humanity, the lovers of the country, are going to find the strength. I think more people are aware in their souls of the right ways to go than we may be conscious of right now. But I think they're moving forward, because freedom, not only God bless America, it's God bless the people of this world, God bless the working people of this world, God bless those that compassion rule and common sense prevail, you know, so that we'll see that the demigods, those who need to steal from the very people who work for them, for example, we need to focus in on a moral agenda, you know, that makes sense in the world. It's a worldwide challenge. The artists have a mandate to clarify the terrain, to put decency in context, and to interpret the world for the newcomers, you know, to be responsible elders and to do the things in which we believe. We can't fall behind. It's real and very necessary. And I've been encouraged to know that a lot of young people know about struggle.
Done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read.
Ruby Dee's readings, Calling All Women,
from Langston Hughes and John Oliver Killens and Sojourner Truth were cocooned within the songs, the music, that cry out against inequality, poverty, and in support of human rights. The selections from Ella Fitzgerald, Come Sunday, Cordell Reagan, Brown Baby, Marian Anderson, Motherless Child, from Wynton Marsalis' Blood on the Field, from Pat Humphrey's Bread and Roses, and Bev Grant's We Were There. You've been listening to a Building Bridges production. Special thanks for technical assistance to Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
They jailed and beat our bodies. Our spirit never died. We were there in the factories. We were there in the mills. We were there in the mines and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line. We raised our voices loud. It makes me proud. Just knowing we were there.